Support comes from Catholic Charities. Driven by the message of love your neighbor, Catholic Charities is focused on improving lives in Maryland. Give the gift of love during this holiday season and learn more at cc-md.org/love.
I got out of the car in my trench coat, of course, carrying my locked, nondescript canvas bag, and I went into a phone booth.
So I started walking down the hallway, and as I passed, everyone would stop talking and just look up at me walking down the hall.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast. I'm Laura Wexler.
And I'm Jessica Henkin. This week on the podcast, Spies Like Us, two stories about being pegged as the wrong guy. The first story is from Wayne Larrave, who is a retired government official, shall we say, who worked for an agency that has three initials in our area, which there are many agencies that have three initials.
There are.
So you get to guess which one. Take a listen.
So in the early 1980s, I worked for one of those three-letter federal government agencies that you're not allowed to talk about outside of work. We were at the height of the Cold War. The United States and the Soviet Union were toe-to-toe, creating all kinds of mischief for one another across the global landscape. And the role of the intelligence community was to use the authorities that we had been given by Congress to acquire information that would not otherwise be known and make that information available to U.S. government decision makers to help them in their task. And that was my job when I first started in the early 1980s in the intelligence community. And I started with all these terrible briefings that they give you in which they threaten you with the implications of failing at your job or creating an unauthorized disclosure of classified information. I mean, in the orientation, when they tell you the death penalty is possibly a human resources outcome of one of your actions, it's very crystallizing and it makes you pay attention to what you're doing, and it may explain why I was so rigid in the processes that I followed. So the information is only of value if you can actually deliver it to somebody. And typical customers were executive branch agencies and senior leaders of those agencies, and certainly the military was a primary customer of ours. And the types of information that we would share with them were about what you would expect: movements of military forces in foreign countries, hostile threats that may exist to U.S. interest overseas, espionage activities aimed at the U.S., all the sort of national security stuff that you would expect. The key was to get it to those people in a timely and actionable manner. Now think about it. It's early 1980. Many of you were not born then. That's fine. I'll explain it to you. A lot of the technology that we have today, and that frankly we very much take for granted, did not exist or did not exist widely in the early 1980s. Cell phones, computers, what a horrible world. Texting, the ability to send email, the ability to ship files around. And so how is it possible for us to provide timely, actionable information to decision makers in Washington, D.C.? Well, we took an example from the Pony Express, and I was one of those Pony Express riders. So every morning when I would come in, I had five or six customers in the D.C. area that I was responsible for supporting. I would visit them on regularly scheduled days at very specific times. They knew I was coming. So I would come into work in the morning. I would pull out all of the traffic that came in overnight. I would sort it out into little piles for each of the agencies that I was visiting. I would wrap them following some very specific and arcane procedures, stuff them into a locked canvas bag, and exit the building where a motor pool vehicle was waiting for me, that was my horse, to ride me around to these locations so I could deliver this information to these decision makers. Now, that seems arcane given the speed of information, but in the 1980s, the early 1980s, the speed of information wasn't that great. All of our adversaries had the same information sharing challenges, so we could move at a more deliberate pace and still meet the goal. I would arrive at these customer locations and usually be met at the door by the one or two people who were authorized to see the information. They would walk me around bypassing all the security procedures and the turnstiles, and we would go back into their building, typically into a very small locked room, not much larger than literally a broom closet. And I would unpack the information and spread it out for them to read. And read was all that they could do. because we were not in a space that was authorized to conduct a discussion of highly classified information. So it became this sort of weird mime where they'd be holding something up and pointing at it and raising their eyebrows and gesticulating in all manner to demonstrate for me that this was valuable, we'd like more of this. And I would take a few notes. When they were done, I'd pack the information up, seal it back in that canvas bag, go out, meet my driver, and go to my next stop. So that was my job, kind of routine, kind of boring. But boring was okay. We got good stuff done. I mean, right, we won the Cold War. Everything's great now, right? So that worked out really well. So it was a fairly predictable pattern until one day in the afternoon, we got a phone call. There was an extraordinarily sensitive piece of intelligence that indicated there was a very serious threat to an overseas activity that was part of an organization called the United States Information Agency. Brief sidebar, U.S. Information Agency created in 1954 with the sole purpose of educating the foreign public about America, American policy, and American culture. So think about Voice of America and those sorts of activities, foreign language broadcast of U.S. information. So this information was so perishable it needed to be acted on immediately. And the individuals who could take action on it in the overseas location where the problem was potentially going to be already had the information. It was decided that the director of the U.S. Information Agency should be briefed on this information immediately. He was the only person who could see it because he was the only person who had the clearance and authorization to see this information. This is a customer we had never visited before. They had no experience with us. They didn't know who we are. We were just going to show up out of nowhere with this highly sensitive information and ask to see the director of the agency. Now, the director of the U.S. Information Agency at the time was no ordinary director. He was a personal friend of then-President Ronald Reagan. And so the security and privacy bubble around Charles Wick, the head of the U.S. Information Agency, was a little bit tighter than many of his predecessors had ever experienced. So I packed up the information, ran down to get in the car. My boss was going to call ahead of me, it's about a 30-minute trip, and vet me into the building so that I would immediately be taken up to see Mr. Wick, could share the information with him, and get out of his busy day. So the driver dropped me off across the street from the entrance to the building. I got out of the car in my trench coat, of course, carrying my locked, nondescript canvas bag, and I went into a phone booth. Now, do I have to explain that to anyone? If you Google it, because I was to call Mr. Wick's office, let them know I was here so that I could then move across the street and be expedited in the building. So imagine this phone conversation. Mr. Wick's office, may I help you? This is Mr. Murphy from the Department of Defense. I'm here to see Mr. Wick. I'm sorry, could you repeat that, please? Mr. Wick is expecting me. I need to see him immediately on an urgent matter. Hold the line, please. Another voice gets on. Hello, I'm on Mr. Wick's personal staff. Can I help you? Yes, I'm here to see Mr. Wick. Okay. And who are you? Mr. Murphy from the Department of Defense. Mr. Wick is expecting to see me. This is an urgent matter. I need to see him immediately. Another voice gets on the line. Hello, can you tell me where you're calling from? And I remember whispering. I don't know why I whispered, but I said, I'm in the phone booth across the street. And I swear, I'll bet everyone in that suite got up, leaned, looked out the window, and said, oh my God, there's a nut in the phone booth down there, and I think he has a bomb. So they continued to put different people on the phone, and I'm talking to them. And then suddenly I realized they had come to their senses, because I'm thinking, these people are imbeciles. Don't they know who I am? These two guys in suits come out of the front of the building, and instead of crossing the street directly toward me, they went diagonally until they were on opposite sides of me on my side of the street, and they came toward me standing in the phone booth. One guy flashed a badge and said, sir, would you mind putting that bag down and stepping out of the phone booth? I am not letting go of this bag. This bag is staying with me at all times. Sir, are you armed? And so I opened my coat and I said, no, because that would be like crazy, right? So they said, why don't you come with us across the street? And I was like, finally, we're getting some action here. So they walked me gingerly across the street, keeping a safe distance. As soon as we get in the door, there's a magnetometer and an x-ray machine. And they want the bag on the x-ray machine and me in the magnetometer. And I said, not happening. You will not x-ray this bag. And again, it's me worried about the death penalty. You will not x-ray this bag. I'll walk through the magnetometer with the bag, which of course set off all the bells and whistles. So they were... literally, I think people in the lobby were like this behind their furniture when I walked in, because clearly there was some nut coming in the building. So they took me down the hallway to this rather nondescript building. It actually reminded me of the interrogation room on The Wire. I kept waiting for Bunk and McNulty to come in. And they kept asking what to them were probably perfectly reasonable questions, and I was giving them perfectly ambiguous and not satisfying answers. This went on for way too long, and I could see the tension level and the nervousness of these fellows who probably thought they were going to die in that room today, elevating. Well, finally, there was a knock on the door, and a hand reached in a piece of paper, and the one agent took it. He looked at it. He looked at me. He looked at it. He looked back at me. He said, "Are you Mr. Murphy?" I said, "Yes," I told the person I talked to on the phone across the street. "Come with me." So quietly, he led me to the elevator, went up to the top floor. As soon as I went into the suite, all eyes were like following me like laser beams. I was taken into Mr. Wick's office. The door was closed. I unpacked the information. I let him read it only, couldn't talk about it. He appreciated the sharing of the information. And I thought, these people are morons. How can we ever support a customer like this who doesn't appreciate the value of the service that we're providing? We're giving him actionable information with which to make important, responsible decisions. So I got back in the car, and I went back to the office. And I started right off the bat with my boss. I said, "You wouldn't believe what happened when I got down there." He goes, "Yeah, yeah." He says, "I'm sorry. I called, and the number was busy. So I thought, I got 30 minutes. He went to the cafeteria to get a sandwich. And he ran into an old friend, and they sat down and forgot all about this gangly 20-year-old in a trench coat who was putting his life at risk to deliver information to the head of the U.S. Information Agency. Incredible. He finally did remember that he was supposed to call. He made the call, and that triggered the note that was passed in. So what I'd like to believe is that somewhere in the United States, in a venue much like this tonight, there's a guy standing up before a microphone and saying, "I used to be the head of security of the U.S. Information Agency, and I had the craziest experience one day." Thank you all very much. I appreciate it.
Oh, gosh, I love Wayne. Is just also just like the nicest guy. And I will say that after he told this story, he sent me a mug in the mail from the agency, which I'm not going to say what agency, because he never said in the story. But it's the agency's like merch.
I think that agency employed someone I know very well.
Yes, I think so too. Okay, we'll be back after this short break with another story from the Stoop.
So this next storyteller, Ellis Marsalis, has quite a winding tale to share, and it's full of misdirection and really dashes your expectations, just like a really good spy.
This is a bit of an odd story. It takes place right up the street 34 years ago, over there on Falls Road, I think, at the Hamden Recreation Center. Before I start that, I wanted to say that originally I grew up in Louisiana. I grew up in a small town outside of New Orleans called Kenner, which is a part of Jefferson Parish. And I grew up in the late 60s and 70s, and it was a what you would call a classic southern town. All of the black people lived in one section on this side of the railroad tracks by the river. And all the white folks lived on the other side of the railroad tracks, except the older ones who lived downtown. So it was like a little square, a square, and then a little square that was downtown. And it wasn't, I don't have any horror stories. It was what it was. You understood where the lines are drawn. It wasn't that we couldn't cross the other side of the railroad tracks. We did quite frequently. But, you know, you just knew this is where we live, that's where they live. And one other thing about the they is they were not Brady Bunch white kids. These are what we would call cornbread-eating white boys. So my grandmother and my mom would always warn us about going over the other side, because my grandmother would say, you know, those white folks over there practice what she called white folk nonsense. And so you did make friends, but it was always whatever it was. It was a kind of a delicate balance. You had a certain degree of comfortability with the situation, and you just rolled with it. And the word cracker is sometimes used affectionately, depending on the context. So, 1990, I leave the Army. I was in Fort Sill, Oklahoma. I move to Baltimore, and I settle in right here on Maryland Avenue in Charles Village, and I called the city because I was interested in coaching Little League Baseball because I had done it before. I was a camp counselor and other stuff, and they said, well, where do you live? I said, I live here on Maryland Avenue, and they said, okay, well, the closest one is this rec center in Hamden. So I said, okay, well, then I'll go by there. So I waited about a month or so, May, around the same time when it opened up. And at the time, I rode a motorcycle. I took my motorcycle, and I rode over there, parked out in front of the rec. And then I walked in, and there was a whole bunch of white kids out front. And there was even more white kids and family members inside the building. And as I walked in, all the kids kind of just looked up at me, and they stopped talking. And I walked into the rec, and there was a woman sitting at a table, and she says, can I help you? And I said, well, I see a sign out for Little League Baseball managers, assistant managers. I was thinking I would sign up, volunteer. So she says, well, you got to go down the hallway to the cage, they called it, where all the baseball bats and were. So as I turn a corner, the hallway's filled with people, 50 or 60 kids, parents, all white. So I start walking down the hallway, and as I passed, everyone would stop talking and just look up at me walking down the hall. So I get all the way to the cage, and I said, guy shows up, old guy goes, can I help you? And I said, well, I was looking to volunteer for a Little League Baseball coach, assistant coach. And he says, how'd you get here? I said, well, I rode over from Maryland Avenue. And he says, why are you here? So I said, well, I wanted to coach Little League Baseball. There's a sign out front. And the city sent me over here. And he kind of stopped. And he turns around, and there's some other people behind him, older people, two women, two guys, and they all kind of huddle together. And I'm looking at him, and what I presumed was, I know every city has their neighborhoods, and I figured, okay, this is one of those neighborhoods. They're going to tell me that, we don't have any positions open. Try some other time or next year or some other place. I was perfectly capable of saying, okay, great, take it easy. They met for a few minutes, and then he turns around, and he has a clipboard in his hands, and he said, so the city sent you over here? I said, yeah. So he gives me the clipboard. He said, you fill this out, and we'll call you to see if we have an assignment. So I went to take the clipboard, and he wouldn't quite let it go. He's kind of... And he lets it go, and I fill it out, give it to him, and then I leave. I walk out, and everybody's just kind of looking at me. And I leave, and I go, okay, I'm probably never going to hear from these people again. Which, at the time, I'm thinking, fine by me. So about 2 weeks later, they call me. And he says, we have a position. We want you to come and see. He goes, he's a little younger than you, but he's the manager. You be the assistant manager. I said, okay. I was surprised. I said, all right, well, I'll see you on Friday or whatever the day it was. I went down there. I met the coach. He was younger. He was like maybe 20. I was like 23. And so we talked. And he said, this is the team you're going to belong to. This is your coach. Your practice field is all the way at the end. So I was a little surprised. I said, okay, well, I took it all the way down to the end. And we got to the team. And everything was fine. We said, okay, well, this is the team. We listened to the team. The team kind of stared at me a little bit. And we started to practice. Now, as we practiced, the third baseman, who was about 11 years old, He was chewing tobacco. He was had a can of Copenhagen, which I was familiar with because I was in the Army. I go, that's okay. And the funny thing was his mom would hold the spit can for him across the white line. And she sat in a little lawn chair, and he would hold his hand out, and she'd run over, and he'd spit in it, and she'd run back over it, and I'm going. So I told the coach, I said, look, you know, the problem, I'm not worried about the chewing tobacco part. It's that it's taking too much time out of the practice. He's stopping, he's going over there, and we're like, and the guy goes, well, you need to talk to his mama. I said, why don't you talk to his mama? And he goes, you talk to his mama. So I said, okay. I mean, once again, I'm aware of the situation, generally speaking. I'm not afraid of these people. I said, okay, I'll go talk to his mama. I said, ma'am, we got to stop at the chaw. This is not working, just timing-wise. It's too much time in the practice for the back and the forth with the spitting. And she looked at me. She picked up her little lawn chair, and she says, well, very well, then. She went over. He spit it all out in the can, and she went and sat down behind the line, and the practice continued. So I was a little surprised by that. I'm like, oh, that was okay. So whenever we would practice, I would see that the what I call the recreation brain trust, which these two old guys, they would sit on the outside of the rec, and they would watch us practice, which I always thought was kind of weird, because I'm like, well, they don't watch any other teams. Well, what's that all about? And whenever I would go back, they were always meeting, and they would come out and greet me and go, so how's everything going? I'm like, it's fine. It's Little League baseball. You know, we got bats and balls. Everything's great. So at one point in the middle of the season, we had one kid, and this is typical, stereotypical. This is like if you ever seen the Bad News Bears, the one kid who's supposed to be a really good baseball player but a pain in everybody's ass. This kid is supposed to be, now I never saw him play, so I couldn't vouch whether he played or not, but he was running around irritating everybody. And the coach would like chase him off. I would chase him off, and he'd come back, and he starts throwing stuff at the players. So I go out to the field. I says, I'm going to get rid of this kid once and for all. So I go out there, and I don't really chase him. I kind of move fast. He separates a little bit, and he kind of runs around me, and I say, look, man, you need to stay away from the field while we're practicing. And he says, you can't tell me anything, and I walk a little close to him, and he says, get away from me. So at that point, it was almost like an icebreaker. I'm like, well, finally. Because I think you're probably speaking for the whole place here. So I told him, I says, look, I'll stay away from you if you stay away from the field. You come out on this field, you got to deal with me every time. So when he said that, one of the other kids said, oh, I heard him gasp. He tells another kid, and then he runs over and tells this other kid. So when the kid leaves, I turn around. I see the coach of the team, the man, running away from the field towards the rep. And I'm like, where is he going? What the hell? So I was like, all right, well, let's just keep practicing. So we continue to practice, and eventually the manager comes back. I'm like, where'd you go, man? He says, oh, I just had to go down to the rec for a minute. I'm like, okay. So the rec brain trust came out, and they were watching us again. So when practice was over, the coach tells me, I think they want to see you at the rec. So I said, all right. So I go down to the rec. I'm in there. They're all in there. That kid is in there. And they go, we just want to tell you something, that this is a little unusual for us around here, and he's got something to say to you. And I said, hold. I said, stop. I said, I'm not interested in a forced apology. If he wants to apologize to me, I'm at the field. If he doesn't, great. Just keep him away from the field. So he stayed away from the field. Now, in that moment, when we were leaving and he was there and all the kids are in the rec, it occurred to me that all these people are related to each other. Because it reminded me, growing up in Louisiana, there's certain towns, like Chalmette is one of them, where we were told that if you get stopped, or if a sheriff or a deputy says something to you, and you get a ticket and you got to go before a judge, don't say anything about that deputy, because that's probably his cousin on the bench, and the bailiff is probably his brother. And it's, there are towns in Louisiana that have one high school, and everybody goes to that, and they are all like this. And I felt like that, in that wreck going, just the way they talked to each other, the way they leaned on each other, it was like, all right, this is like some kind of extended family here. And I'm in the middle of that, and I'm like, eh, but I didn't really bother them. I'm like, I'm not here to try to convert anybody to anything. I was just here to coach baseball. So we go through the season. Now, the next week, because, you know, you separate by about 4 or 5 days, I go back. My coach says, so how's everything going? I'm like, everything is fine. So he says to me, so, you know, what do you think of Mayor Smoke? And I'm like, I don't know. What should I think of Mayor Smoke? Now, just a brief separation here. I had been in Baltimore 5 months. I didn't know who the mayor was. It didn't mean, like, I don't think of, like, I didn't go to a city and say, well, let's get into politics. So he says to me, he goes, you know, he's the city's first black mayor. And I'm like, oh, that was the first time I heard that. I said, okay, great. And I said, you know, the first black mayor that I experienced was in 1979. So that's pretty good, 10 years. All right. I didn't think anything of it at the time. I was like, what does that have to do with anything? So he says, oh, just you know, whatever. We're just you know, just letting you know. Just, you know, talk. I said, okay, fine. So we continued through the season. We played the games. I never see that other kid again. That's fine. I see him, but he doesn't come by the field. And so we go into the playoffs. We lose the first game of the playoffs. And at that point, season's over. I get my stuff. I go to the coach, I shake his hand, I say, all right, man, that's it. I'm going to leave, and I'm, in my mind, I'm saying, I'm never coming back to this place again. But I, on my way out, he says to me, he says, so, how did we do? I said, well, what do you mean, how did we do? We lost the first round of the playoffs. He says, no, the rec, how did the rec do? What do you mean, how did the rec do? The rec is fine. Well, you know, I mean, don't you have to report back to the city? I'm like, what are you talking about? Report back to what city? Well, you said the city sent you over here. I said, the city didn't send me over here. They sent me over here because I called them up. So he started to laugh, and he puts his head down. Now, I still don't quite know what he's talking about. I'm like, what's so damn funny? So he goes, you know, everybody in the rec thought that you were sent over here by the city to keep an eye on us. And I'm like, keep an eye on you for what? What? Baseball? So he's like, oh, don't worry about it. That's pretty funny, though. I'm like, I guess so. So I get on my bike, and I'm riding back. And it just dawned on me what the hell just happened the past 3 months. I'm like saying, well, that's why everybody was acting so weird. That's what the meetings are for. That's why he didn't let go of the clipboard. And he's like, that's why I'm even here in the first place. I'm like, oh, welcome to Baltimore.
Oh gosh, it's so funny. And I wanted so badly, he told that story at a venue in Baltimore in Hamden,
yeah,
like a block away from the rec center. I wanted so badly to find all those characters and invite them, but it's, you know, unlikely.
I just love how you think this is an issue of race, and in fact it's that they've pegged him for a city spy.
And he's like, I don't know who, I just moved here. I barely know who your mayor is. That's, you know.
So good. Thanks so much for listening to our episode this week.
We want to thank our super talented producer, Maureen Harvey, for...
Who's definitely not a spy.
We love her, and we are so grateful that she has our back.
Tune in to a special edition of the Stoop Storytelling Series on WYPR, August 11th at 4 p.m. and again at 11. Visit StoopStorytelling.com for information about shows and upcoming events and to listen to stories from our past shows. And we will be back soon with more stories from the Stoop.
Support comes from Catholic Charities. Driven by the message of love your neighbor, Catholic Charities is focused on improving lives in Maryland. Give the gift of love during this holiday season and learn more at cc-md.org/love.